Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week. This is the Roguecast for Wednesday, April 15th. And gentlemen, it's another big news week.
Yeah,
we'll have a lot of that before. But it's a quieter Rogues Gallery news week, so let's knock that out real quick.
Yes.
We only have one more event this month. That is April 20th. Next Monday is going to be Settlers of Catan over at Mesa Rosa.
Awesome. You know, Settlers is the I know I've mentioned this to y'all. I don't know if customers know it, but it was it is the board game for my mom and sister who had never really played any of the Euro games. They did Monopoly, Scrabble, etc. And what I remember is pretty strong resistance to it at first.
Mm-hmm.
We made maybe the mistake of trying to kind of explain the rules without sort of just doing a walkthrough of the game
and play
some rounds or whatever, which I usually find a better way to learn it. Once we had played that first game, though, they just loved it.
Yeah, so, it is the gateway drug into other board games.
I was going to say it's the sort of king of board games in a lot of sense.
Yep.
That and Carcassonne.
Yep. So that is April 20th. Then we get into May. And, well, May 3rd is the big holiday for comics. Free comic book day.
I thought it was May 2nd.
Is it May 2nd?
Sometimes it's May 2nd, sometimes... It's
well,
the
now,
first,
now
it's
I'm,
the
it's
first
the first Saturday.
Saturday.
Now I'm not sure. Yeah. It is May 2nd.
Woo!
Oh, sorry. I got the wrong day.
This is the weird, Randy, because you are usually so on about these things, and I am usually so off.
What's weird is I hope I don't have the wrong day on our website. I'll have to go double check
that. We'll look into that. May 2nd.
Saturday, May 2nd is Free Comic Book Day. We actually have our comics in hand. We haven't had a chance to count them all yet because we've got well over 5,000, closer to 6,000 comics to give away this year.
But we've done a little bit of casual reading and we've turned up some good stuff. So it looks like it's going to be a strong year.
Yeah. And we'll when we get a couple weeks out, we'll give our sort of our impressions of these are the ones you want to grab off the table.
Personal favorites.
Yeah, personal favorites.
Yeah.
But so that's coming up on May 2nd. And then May 12th will be our Ladies' Night. May 13th will be our Reading with Rogues, which we'll be doing Why the Last Man in May.
Yep. By the way,
book one.
It occurs to me, I think Ladies' Night, I believe, did their first at Star Coffee.
Star Coffee, yeah.
And I think things went really well. I talked to the guy at Star the day before to make sure it was they were all cool with it. Everything seemed cool. And I gather everybody had a great time. So.
Good to know. And then just jumping a little bit forward, on June 20th is a Free RPG Day. So we'll have some RPG stuff to give away. So, a lot of stuff coming up.
That is a lot of stuff.
And then, of course, we'll have our all-ages event sometime in June, but we're not unveiling that till Free Comic Book Day. But we've got some exciting news on that. We've got one of our guests is locked in and booked and everything. I've got a bunch of guests sort of lined up, and it's going to be – we'll reveal the lineup on Free Comic Book Day as always.
Yep.
All right, so moving on to other news for the week. First one is Marvel has announced their variants for, I believe, July – maybe. Mm-hmm. They're going to do Spider-Gwen variants.
Oh, right. Yeah, I knew we were going to talk about this, but I forgot about it. It's like Gwen Stacy in the tradition of Spider-Gwen.
Yes.
As every single Marvel superhero.
Yes. Yeah. So
like Gwen Stacy Hulk.
Gwen the Incredible Hulk, yeah. And they revealed only three. They revealed the Incredible Hulk, they revealed Doctor Strange, and I forget what the other one is.
Am I correct that they were having a bit of fun and they used her name and everything, so it's like the Incredible Gwen and stuff like that?
The Gwenable Hulk or something like that.
That's what it
is like that. And it looks like fun. Marvel doesn't do the thing DC does, though, where it's like available to order and we can order as much as we want.
Right.
Which means they're going to be hard to come by, which is kind of too bad.
Yeah, that is too bad.
I kind of wish we'd be able to order and get when people want them.
As always, it would be really awesome if they put together, even if it wasn't like a hardcover or something, but you remember how DC used to do those like a Sandman gallery that was just a comic?
Yeah, just a comic of all those.
Yeah, like so 30-page comic, 30 different covers, or 50 pages. Or
I would love them to do that. I mean, they'll all be like, if you get the Incredible Hulk trade, the Spider-Gwen variant will be in it.
Yeah.
But if you want like all the Spider-Gwen variants, there's no way to get them easily, which is kind of too bad.
I think that'd be something that people would pick up.
I agree.
You know, it's not a high print run thing, but you know, we'd probably sell 20 of them or something like that.
You know, nobody's listening to us on that.
No. But, write your congressman, listeners.
Yes, write your congressman. That seems important.
Write your Stanley, listeners.
Other comics news. If you follow Rat Queens, the comic on Facebook, they posted these D&D 5th edition character sheets for all the Rat Queens, written by a series writer, Curtis Weeby.
Is he a D&D person?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if that was definitive.
Yeah, no, he's a D&D person.
Okay, because I did look at these last night, and they're really cool. Like, they have all the little notes on them.
I mean, just reading the book, it's kind of obvious.
Yeah,
I mean, just
that he's a D&D
little
fan.
Nods here and there.
But I noticed, like, I guess, does D&D 5th edition have, like, you kind of write, like, a little backstory thing, or, like, you have, like, a hook for your character, like, a one-sentence sort of thing? And, you know, every one of them has that, and they seem to have, he seems to have thought it through quite well. I saw fans debating particulars in the comments, as only D&D fans can. Yeah.
It's pretty
like,
neat.
I think her charisma should be higher, or whatever. Yeah. And then somebody else is like, no, what about when she punched so-and-so?
It is pretty neat. If you're a Rat Queens fan, especially one who plays D&D, check that out.
It would be cool as if, like, for the next collection, if D&D would just give them the okay, and why wouldn't they? It's cool press, extra press, to include official character sheets with the characters.
I don't think they need D&D's okay for that.
Let's see, the character sheets are probably essentially, what do you call it, open license.
Well, it's open license, yeah. I imagine that they could do that if they wanted to.
Yeah, maybe they should.
And they may. I mean, maybe when they do the hardcover, they probably will do.
Awesome. The second trade is coming, and I'm sure a hardcover is on its way.
So, moving out of comics and into TV news, we just watched the teaser for the last 5 episodes of Arrow and Flash this season.
Yep. Well, it's a teaser in the sense that it promotes them, but it's not a teaser for them.
It doesn't contain any of the. It doesn't contain any footage from the show. Dave and I were part of Trailer Blockade. We were not watching it, and then Nick was like, "No, it's not stuff from the show."
Yeah, it's just like it's a self-contained little thing.
It's a little Fight Club,
right? It's a sort of short where it's like Green Arrow is like, "Come on, kid! You know, now that you're in the superhero club to Flash, he's like, it's time you found out about this." And it's, like, got all the heroes and all the villains.
Yep.
And it's, like, well-produced. There's special effects.
Yeah, it's really fun.
But it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. Obviously, they would... I mean, like, Reverse Flash, who's, like, the evilest villain of them all, is in there. But and it's all kind of played like...
Yeah, it's sort of a meta thing where the villains and heroes meet up and fight. They're playing their characters. They're not playing the actors.
Right.
But they're not playing the... all the stuff is like there wouldn't be a fun fight between Arrow and Ra's al Ghul either.
Right.
I mean, this is all sort of a out of context.
Heatwave is watching, and he like something cool happens, and he said, "Then he's gonna go like cool."
Yeah.
Or
well,
like
when
that.
Firestorm shows up,
of course,
because Heatwave's a pyromaniac.
Right. But he probably would not normally cheer the arrival of
no.
a...
Oh, I don't know. He probably...
he might, actually.
Yeah, actually, he's kind of nuts.
But they've got... They've got somebody keeping score, which is kind of neat. It's a fun little teaser.
If you're a fan of the shows, you should definitely watch
it. Just look up Flash Arrow crossover trailer, and that'll pull it up. And it's, again, not spoilers for what's going on, just kind of a neat little riff on that show.
And also tune into Flash tonight, because it's
yep,
back.
Flash is back.
Oh, right. Those are some serious barn burner episodes recently.
It's
big
really good
reveals.
Well, 5 episodes left. We're getting some big stuff.
Yeah.
Also tonight is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yay!
Which I'm a little down on, but still watching.
And Nick is very, very pleased with it.
And
I love the show. So.
And they're doing a spinoff.
That's right.
All they've said is we're doing a spinoff.
No name.
We don't know.
No characters.
We don't know what characters is. We assume it's in modern day. It's not more Agent Carter. It's a spinoff.
Yeah, it's a spinoff.
But who knows? It could be Inhumans. I don't think they'll do Inhumans.
I'm gonna say wait till probably Age of Ultron. Something will happen that it will splinter and things will occur.
You're probably right.
Maybe it's an Ultron variety show.
I like it. The Carol Burnett with Ultron.
That's right. And anybody who doesn't please Ultron will be destroyed by him.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's the heavy favorite betting. Diverting for a second to the world of video games, one of our former customers posted a link to a game called Warhammer End Times Vermintide.
Yes. Well, that's a bit of a mouthful.
I think they're just calling it Vermintide.
Okay.
Like Warhammer's for people who know Warhammer, but they're calling it Vermintide. That's
Vermintide
the actual name of the game.
It is.
And it is basically a Left 4 Dead in the Warhammer universe.
Yeah. There's a video going out there from PC Gamer magazine with... two of the editors or whatever, talking it over while you watch about 5 minutes of video.
Yeah.
So you get a pretty good overview, even though they only had 2 of the 5 possible characters to play.
Right.
And they say it's clearly, you know, it's using the Left 4 Dead model. I mean, you could say ripoff, but they say that, like, the powers and stuff are all different enough that it is not, like, a clone.
Yeah.
It is just very clearly inspired by, and I guess, you know, wears that on its sleeve. It's not trying to hide it or anything.
Well, and isn't it Skaven and undead kind of thing?
Yeah,
I mean,
so you've got the Warhammer fantasy universe.
Yeah.
Doing Left 4 Dead type stuff, so it looks like you're passing through this sort of those medieval cities, and it may even be what is it, Mordheim?
Yeah, Mordheim.
I think
it is Mordheim based.
Okay, yeah. So that was their city where there's all these like kind of constant warfare and skirmishes and this guerrilla warfare.
It's not unlike what D&D has with Ravenloft, except more British and gothy.
Right. And so you've got characters you can play that look like, and they said like a wizard, a fighter.
Looks like an inquisitor.
Oh, is it inclusive?
I thought I saw. I saw a dude with a hat.
I know that one of them is. I think has like a is like a. It must be a guardsman or an imperial or whatever because he had like a gun.
I think that's the Inquisitor.
Okay, that would make sense. That makes sense. And just right off the bat, the graphics were amazing.
Yeah, it looks really good.
You see lots of Skaven, their little rat men, racing around and piling into people. And the physics are really nice. And they talk about how, like, if you've got, like, the twin swords of the fighter or whatever, and you're, like, carving away at these guys, you'll see heads, tails, arms being lopped off. But in other words, it sounds kind of gruesome, but they don't just die the same way every time, which would be kind of boring in a first-person shooter with just lots and lots of enemies.
So lots of family fun entertainment.
Family fun.
Honestly, Left 4 Dead could be played by youth.
I had sort of written it off because I thought it was just a PC game. But apparently it's at least going to be on PS4.
I would think you would need that to next-generation systems to get those graphics.
Yeah.
There was also, like, somebody who was firing off arrows, at high speed, leglessing into them. They did mention that, like, the unique zombies of Left 4 Dead, like the boomers and what was the thing with the tongue?
I don't remember
anymore. Whatever. There were Skaven and stuff in this that were doing similar things, like one who... But they said it kind of happened differently. Like, there was one who had, like, a hook gun or something he would, like, impale you with, and then he would drag you off into, like, areas that had a lot more of them. It functions similarly.
Well, I'm sure there'll be, like, warpstone mutants and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I mean, that's a thing.
Oh, they even mentioned there was one who had, like, that was, like, a rattling gunner or whatever.
They
had, like, the equivalent of, like, that sort of medieval chain gun thing.
Yeah.
And they said, like, if you get nailed by this guy, he will target one character in particular.
Yeah.
And he can knock you from 100 hit points to zero in, a second or two if you don't get out of there. So, surprisingly on my map now.
Looks like fun. And we'll post a link to that so people can watch it. Moving into movie news, they have cast Psylocke for the X-Men Apocalypse.
Right.
And it is Olivia Munn.
Right.
Who we all love from Newsroom.
Yeah, she was great in Newsroom.
Yeah, a lot of people know from, was it G4?
Yeah,
Attack of the Show?
Yeah. She's a comics fan. She's been tagged by many as a fake geek girl. I think she's more than earned her credit at this point. Yeah. But more importantly, on Newsroom, she proved she had acting chops.
Yeah, I actually don't care whether somebody likes comics or not when
it
comes to portraying a character.
Yeah, me neither.
As long as she can act well, and I think she has a certain aloofness, that she kind of pulls off, and I think that kind of fits Psylocke.
Yeah.
Obviously, she's beautiful, she looks Psylocke-ish.
Yeah. The only question I have is whether or not she can handle the martial artsy action type stuff, but, anyone can train for that,
Or be stunt doubled in.
Yeah. I've seen an equal mix of people going, oh, that's perfect, which was my reaction, to, oh, God, why? Which is probably a little over the top.
Yeah.
I
was actually never a huge into Psylocke. I don't dislike her.
Yeah.
But she kind of seemed like sort of 90s eye candy to me.
Yeah.
Like she was a super sexy ninja who was kind of like a badass, but maybe didn't have much else depth to her.
See, I always loved Psylocke, but I loved her pre-ninja.
Yep. When she was Betsy Braddock.
When she was Betsy Braddock. But after the ninja thing, it kind of grew on me.
Did she get merged, or did the Betsy Braddock persona go away completely?
Well, there's an extremely long storyline that I could give you that doesn't explain it very well.
Did she generally get merged?
More or less, the Mandarin turned her into a ninja.
Okay. She's not going to be saying governor
The question is, when I believe that it was always read as her being an Asian ninja with a British accent.
Okay.
I believe that to be the vibe. But I don't know. There's no rule. They can do whatever they want.
Right. Wasn't her brain like put into another?
That was the later long explanation.
Yeah.
When she showed up, she basically here was the origin. Jim Lee wants to draw her as an Asian ninja. That was her origin as the new Psylocke. They went through the Siege Perilous and they all changed.
Yeah.
But honestly, they don't need to get into all that for the show. It can just be she's an Asian ninja.
Psylocke has a cool visual power.
Yeah.
Her like psychic things manifest as like these blades coming out of her hand.
Yep.
But it's like pure psychic powers.
Very 90s, but kind of fun.
But she can stab you, and it's not going to be all blood and guts. You're just going to be in pain.
I have the same fondness for Psylocke that I do for Gambit, which is to say, can be a really terrible 90s character. Probably most of the time I don't want to see him. But done right, I have a fondness.
I think I actually like Gambit a little bit more, or I just know more about him.
I think Psylocke's a good addition to this. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm down with it.
Yeah.
Do you prefer more Bishop or Psylocke?
I like Bishop too, actually, to be honest.
That's a tough one.
Just throwing 90s characters at you.
I'm done with either of those, honestly. I'm neutral.
You start getting into Adam X the Extreme, then we have problems.
Yeah, let's not go there.
But I will say this, the thing I hadn't thought about till right now is that if Psylocke's in there, that opens the door to Captain Britain.
Sure, if they want.
I would love to see Captain Britain on the
screen. Do we think they're going to stick with this X franchise without, like, a full reboot?
I think so for a while, yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure. I mean, Deadpool is going to be part of the extant franchise, right?
Why not? Because
Deadpool is in current times, and this X-Men is in the 80s.
It is. It's in the 80s. Right. They're moving forward. But
right. No, I only meant, are they going to continue making X movies?
Yeah, absolutely.
That essentially spin off of Bryan Singer's from, what, 2000?
Yeah, because the thing is, they can keep losing.
Like a 15-year franchise at this point.
They've proven they can recast, because they're recasting a bunch of people like Storm and all as younger people.
Yep.
So they can redo that. They can keep bringing in people. Like, they bring in Psylocke. They're bringing in Gambit. They're bringing in all these people. They can keep bringing in characters forever.
Yeah, Jubilee.
Jubilee they haven't done yet. Are they bringing in Jubilee on this one?
Yep. They cast her. It's somebody I don't know, but looks Jubilee-ish.
And the other thing is, Dave, I know that you dropped out of the X-Men at this point, but Nick and I know that going forward, they have the Extinction Agenda.
Well, they cast
Have the whatever, the one that created Generation X that was with the Phalanx.
Oh, yeah, the Phalanx Covenant.
The Phalanx Covenant. They have all kinds of big event stories they could base movies around.
And they've also cast Archangel. So
yeah, they've cast Archangel. That's right. So they're clearly they could do this for a while.
By the way, I feel like Jubilee may be the best fit for retroactively dropping her in the 80s
as
the dawn of the mall rat.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I suspect we'll see more of unless Apocalypse tanks, which seems very unlikely.
Who's directing it?
I don't remember.
It's not Vaughn again.
No, it's not.
I think isn't it Singer?
It might be Singer.
Maybe so.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So, other big Marvel news dropped, and that is the Spider-Man news.
All right.
So, Kevin Feige, I don't know how you say it, the guy who's the head of Marvel Studios, who's clearly one of the guys sort of keeping Marvel what Marvel is,
right.
Has said that he told Crave Online that there's a young kid already running around in New York City in a homemade version of the Spider-Man costume in the MCU. He says you just don't know it yet.
That is the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Yeah.
In Spider-Man, people know that.
I don't know.
In Spider-Man's very specific case, where there have been retellings of that origin in the last whatever it's been, 13 years, for us, we are going to take it for granted that people know the specifics. So that means they're not going to redo the origin.
It's just fantastic news.
Because who needs it?
Letting Marvel Studios have their shot at these characters that they've been deprived of, you know, BFF, Spider-Man, X-Men, all that, that they're going to make good decisions with
them. Yeah.
Which is why, you know, hopefully those fall back into their hands at some point.
Their desire is to keep Spider-Man Peter Parker in high school.
Yep, they said pretty young.
And he says the previous films have yanked Peter Parker out of high school as soon as possible. And he said, you know, his desire is to keep Spider-Man in high school as the comics
did. Usually like a senior when they begin.
And he says they've already designed the costume, which is different than any of the ones that have come before, and it's classic Spidey. All saying all the right things.
Yeah.
So
didn't they even show like a picture of it or something?
I think there's only fan pictures. I don't think they've actually shown it yet.
Like, yeah, there was maybe art attached, but that was not official.
But this is all good news, I think. I mean, there was some discussion and some people disappointed, and I'm among them that wanted, we're kind of maybe Miles Morales was going to be the Spider-Man.
Right, and I guess that's the other announcement, is that it's definitively Peter Parker. I do, you know, I grew up with Peter Parker.
Yeah.
Basically my favorite superhero, possibly excepting Batman.
Yeah.
And, I don't have any problem with Peter Parker, obviously, but I felt like if they were going to do Miles Morales, it felt like the time as he was, you know, we know he's going to be in Avengers in the comic, so if you're going to introduce him to the Marvel Universe and have him maybe in the Marvel Universe, or the Cinematic Universe Avengers, you can get all the kind of synergy going on there. And the movies are kind of offering up some of the diversity that we're seeing. You know, it seems likely that do we think that probably Cap will be replaced by Falcon at some point?
At some point, probably.
I'm not sure when that's going to happen, but maybe when the actor is just done with the role.
But I think the thing about Miles Morales is to give Miles Morales an origin without Peter Parker would be really hard. Miles Morales has got to be inspired by Peter Parker.
Yeah, I kind of forgot that. In the Ultimate Universe, he arose when Peter Parker died.
So I think long game wise, this makes sense.
Peter Parker will appear in this movie and die by the end of it. That would be messed up.
Yeah.
Man, what if they had that in the cards because they were going to bring in Miles?
I don't think they are. I think
besides he had kind of grown up a little bit, I guess, in Ultimate Spider-Man. I feel like was he out of high school?
No, I think he was still in high school.
Maybe not. Bendis was working on that one for a while.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I'm gonna go with the put my bet on the long odds that he will appear and die in the
same movie, and then
and Miles will be the will
post credits
at the end of the movie. Yes,
post credit sequence
and be inducted into the Avengers.
Yeah, yeah, that's not excited. That's not going to happen. But
I'm excited that he's going to be in high school, so he can't be part of the Avengers.
Yeah, well, maybe. I don't want him in the Avengers. I like him in the same world.
If he teams up with a character every once in a while,
sure, that's fine.
Spider-Man is the king of team ups.
You know,
but
what I
don't want any version of him on the Avengers.
What I want is for them to get enough rights that he can guest star in season 2 of Daredevil. I don't know how likely that is, but Daredevil and Spidey belong together.
Yeah. Although that's a dark universe portrayed in Daredevil.
Yeah,
Spidey might feel a little bit out of place in there.
Maybe. I think he could do a fun thing, though. But we'll see. Probably not likely to happen. Finally, in movie news, well, not finally, but penultimate movie news, they have announced that, officially, that Phil Lord and Chris Miller, from 21 and 22 Jump Street, from Lego Movie, from Last Man on Earth, are developing The Flash for a standalone movie.
Oh, I don't think I had heard, or I wasn't really up on this one.
Yeah. So they're working on it. I think these are the right guys to do it. They got a sense of fun. They're able to make things work.
What's that movie? Okay, 21
Jump Street.
22 Jump Street.
Yeah, okay. Other stuff too. But I mean, everything they've done has been good.
Yeah,
okay.
They've got a great sense of humor.
Can see it. I've seen a lot of people griping that they're like, "Why don't you just make Grant Gustin the Flash in the movies?" And it's the same thing as the "Why don't make Tom Welling?"
Do they say it with that dumb guy voice?
Yes, because it's dumb. The thing is, the TV show is great. It's a great version of the Flash. Yeah. But I don't want the superhero. DC is not doing a cinematic universe on TV that leads into the movies.
Right.
And they shouldn't. Marvel does it that way and it makes sense for them. But DC's universe can't extend to the films that way.
They're two different companies. They have to have two different approaches.
They've also been playing up their multiverse for like the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And they're doing it in the comics. They're doing it with the toys. They're doing it with the animation. That there's all these different versions of the characters running around. So I don't think people are going to be that thrown by it.
Yeah.
The movie is going to be much more high-octane action.
Yeah.
The show is great with the soap operatics, and honestly, I can't even imagine it being better than the show.
No, me neither, but...
But it could be a different entity that still works on its own.
Well, Lord and Miller doing it makes me much more interested.
Yeah.
It makes me think, okay, I want to see this now. But yeah, I mean, they could do it. I mean, they even if some point could do a Grant Gustin appears as the Flash of Earth 1 in Flash 2 in the movies or something.
Right.
If they want to do that.
Right. If they really
But I don't think this is a slap in the face of the people doing the Flash TV show or anything.
No. Those guys are better off on their own.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see those directors take on this because that goes against everything DC movies have done so far with their weird no fun.
Yeah.
Because Chris,
I wonder,
Phil Lord and all them, that's what they do. They bring the humor.
And that's what I wonder is this they're developing it. Is there going to be a fallout before it happens? Because our next bit of news, leading into our listener question.
Just backing up for just 1 second, though.
Damn it, you ruined my segue.
Sorry, your
segue. What's wrong
with you?
I was kind of volleying it up for...
He was leading me into a segue, Dave.
Taking down both of you.
Son of a...
All right.
You made me forget what I was going to say.
It better be important.
No, talking about the changes, is it possible DC hasn't... Is the success of The Flash is like, okay, and also enough people yelling at them online, maybe we need to allow a little fun into our movies.
I think that'd be entirely likely, if not for the news that we're just about to talk about.
All right, let's talk about it. We don't know.
They just lost Michelle McLaren on Wonder Woman. And
what did she direct?
She has directed a lot of Breaking Bad episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
also
she was
like Better Call Saul.
Better Call Saul. She directed the first Better Call Saul.
Well, yeah.
She was one of the, who was going to bring the fun.
She was one of the main Breaking Bad episodes. No, but she was a great director.
Yeah.
And she's left because of creative differences,
right,
which is code for I wanted to make a good movie, they want to make a crappy one.
You assume that.
I do assume that. I am saying that's what I'm assuming, yes. And the reason I assume that is because of DC's track record
in
the movies.
Maybe she just didn't want to use the invisible jet.
Maybe they want to do fun now, and she didn't want to.
I don't believe that at all. I would love for DC to get on board the fun train, but I don't see that happening. They have hitched their wagon to dark, gritty realism.
I feel like The Flash will be an exception to that. Even if it's notably toned down from the show, but they'll still. I think they probably want to allow some fun with that character.
We'll see. I have no faith.
Some fun in Superman, but there was no fun there.
It's true.
I have no faith that DC can deliver. And every time, so that's why this tempers the Lord Miller news for me, because Lord Miller developing Flash is great news.
Yeah, it is.
Unless they're just going to leave in 6 months.
treatment and they were like,
I forget who's doing the Suicide Squad movie.
David Ayers, who did Fury. Also not super fun.
Yeah.
But that was dark. Now that one makes sense though,
because, as you know, a darker edge to the Suicide Squad movie does make sense.
It does, but I still feel like it, you know, it's got Will Smith as Deadshot. Right. I feel like a little bit of fun in there could be good, but I don't think it's going to be there. I think it's going to be grim and oppressive.
So we shall see.
We shall see. Mm-hmm. I would love to be wrong about this, by the way. I don't hate DC. I love DC's characters, mm-hmm. and I would love for the DC movies to be good. They're just so far have not been at all what I want, and I don't see any changes coming. And Michelle McLaren leaving Wonder Woman is bad news. She's a great director, and you know, for those who it matters, she was an up and coming female director, and right. Now they are left again with, they've already lost Joss Whedon on Wonder Woman at one point. They had him do a script, and they didn't do that.
Right.
So it basically looks like DC doesn't know what to do with Wonder Woman.
Right, or possibly with women in general.
Yeah, and that's not good for them. But we will talk about that more when we get to our listener question.
Yeah, sure.
Which we'll be getting to in just a second after the break. All right. As alluded to in the last segment, our listener question is from Joey Halbert. As all our listener questions are, you can email us, or we post on Facebook every Tuesday. You can post up there. If you ask us a question, we read it on the air, and you are a sub or someone who comes into our shop, we will pull a special prize pack of comics for you, and as a thank you for helping us do the podcast. So, Joey, look for that in the next couple of weeks. But Joey's question is, dream directors for Wonder Woman now that Michelle McLaren has dropped out.
This is kind of tough for me because, you know, although I do like, you know, I like speculating or dream casting and all that stuff.
Sure.
I don't really know a lot about what directors are like, the, you know, who the up-and-coming directors are, who the best guys are.
Yeah, me neither.
I did a quick, right before this, we started recording, I just kind of quick skimmed through a few directors of like kind of action-adventure movies from the last few years, just to give myself a few ideas.
So before we get into the pick specifically, do you guys think it's important for Wonder Woman to have a female director?
Not necessarily.
No, I don't think it...
I think if they can find one, then I think that would be really cool. I don't think it's like I think best person for the job at this point.
I think it needs to have a good story and good characters.
Here's what I would say. I agree with you guys in general, but I do think that given that DC does not have the greatest track record with bringing women into their projects, and given that this is their first big female driven, I think it should be a female director.
That's a reasonable point of view.
I think that I don't think it's like a slap in the face of all women if they don't.
Right.
But I do think they are sort of enabling Hollywood sexism if they don't go out of their way to get a female director, especially since there are a lot of good female directors. They've, of course, lost one of the best.
DC was the company that gave us Gail Simone's Women in Refrigerators page.
Yep.
Which for those who might not know about that. Alludes to the throwaway death of was it Kyle Rayner's girlfriend, killed by a villain and left in his refrigerator. The age, you know, Hollywood's been doing it forever. The old the hero's girlfriend gets killed so he can really want revenge against the bad guys and kick their asses and all that. It's a really cheesy trope. And somebody like, I guess, you know, I forget. Gail Simone started that, but it wasn't just DC. She covered.
No, it was for everybody. She but covered it was Marvel it was DC. Named after the most egregious thing that was done.
One of the trashiest examples.
On the flip side, DC are also the people who really employed Gail Simone for a long time to write things like Wonder Woman, Birds of Prey, Secret Six.
Yep, and DC has at times been a female friendly company, especially when Karen Berger was like one of their best editors ever. You know, they've had. I feel like they started out as having some of the stronger female characters at times when Marvel didn't, like the 90s.
They notably, like Birds of Prey, like I say, was a very female-driven action book. They notably launched Batwoman.
Right.
They had the female Question.
Right, and they're doing good stuff right now with Batgirl. But it does seem like it's become fewer and far between.
Yeah, Marvel does seem to have the edge as far as that goes.
Absolutely. They have a strong edge right now, I'd say. So I would like for DC to pull that off.
So if we're talking female directors,
yes.
I think the obvious one that they're not going to get is Kathryn Bigelow.
Right. She is the sort of the long-running action, female action director.
Yep. She did Zero Dark 30. Hurt Locker. She did Hurt Locker.
Back in the 80s.
Prior to that, she did Near Dark and Point Break.
Yep, Near Dark, which is an awesome Southwestern vampire movie.
Also Strange Days.
Strange Days, that's right. I love Strange Days.
A few other movies that...
I would rather have fun 90s Kathryn Bigelow.
Yeah.
But I suspect that dark gritty Kathryn Bigelow...
She's going to be disarming bombs.
...is probably more like what they'd want.
Probably so. And I do feel like my general impression, kind of like... just kind of from casual observation of the Wonder Woman readers over the years, is that every time DC, like, super warriors her up, like, you know, the second coming of Leonidas from 300.
Right, right.
It's not really quite what fans want. They want her to be...
They want Linda Carter.
They want Linda Carter. They want her to be cool and beautiful, but, like, I feel like they always want some element of wit and lightness to it.
I would bet, just based on the promo pieces and everything, we're going to get Warrior Woman Wonder Woman.
I think so, too. And for that, honestly, Kathryn Bigelow probably is a good choice.
Yeah, I think so. She would be my go-to choice.
She's an excellent director. It sounds so dark thinking. I've seen both of her last two movies. And they're good, but
dark. Yeah, but they're dark. Here's the thing. I think she's unlikely to take the job.
So here's my outside chance.
Sure.
Female director.
Yep.
Julie Taymor.
From Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark?
Yes, but also from Across the Universe. A couple Shakespearean adaptations like Titus and The Tempest.
Okay.
She's known sort of in film, she's kind of known for very vibrant visuals.
Yeah.
I don't know if she's ever worked with a real high budget, but she kind of takes medium budgets and makes them look really
nice.
Across
the Universe had a pretty big budget.
I think so.
Although I have seen... Man, you and I both really like Across the Universe. Nick, did you like Across the Universe?
Yeah, I thought it was good. Some people hate it.
A lot of people hate it.
Yeah.
Like a assume everyone hates it level of hating. It's crazy. And I really liked it. But...
Yeah. Well, we'll have to... maybe that should be our next question to our viewers. Did you like Across the Universe? If so, why? And if not, why not?
And then my pick would be Angelina Jolie.
Oh, right. Who recently directed...
Unbroken.
Unbroken, yeah.
It was actually a quite good movie. It ran a little long, so she maybe needs to tone that
down.
As
an editor, yeah.
A little bit. But she's got a good eye for directing, and I think she's very smart at it, so...
It's not the craziest choice in the world.
She starred in an action movie series, not the best action movie series with Tomb Raider, but...
She had a lot of fun with it.
Actually,
tone-wise, it's not too far from what I would kind of prefer for a Roman movie.
You know, if you got Jolie to direct, you could also get her to star as Hippolyta.
That would be pretty cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think she'd actually be great for that.
So that would be probably a good choice too.
And I have two random picks.
Okay.
If you want an action movie, you go with Justin Lin.
Which makes sense because he's worked with Gal Gadot.
Yeah.
And that's the guy who did the Fast and Furious movies.
Yes, before. And then if you want the really weird one, you go to Wes Anderson.
Oh my God, Wes Anderson's Wonder Woman. I'd watch that in a heartbeat. I would love. There's no way that would ever happen. But it would be like a road movie where she leaves Paradise Island and goes across the U.S. with her dysfunctional relationship with her mother and her absent father Zeus.
Can't you just see it, though?
Oh my God, I would kill to see a Wes Anderson
sort of
Wonder Woman.
I'm imagining Terry Gilliam's Wonder Woman.
I want Saturday Night Live to do this trailer now.
I just was sitting here thinking, I caught like an hour of Grand Budapest Hotel on HBO the other day, and I was like, you know, that was pretty great. The humor was fun. I mean, Wonder Woman, Wes Anderson, sure.
Wes Anderson's Wonder Woman. I'm in, Nick. Let's make this happen. Let's get this trending on Twitter.
Or at least get some fans to make a fan trailer
for it.
A polished fan trailer.
Yes. Dave, what choices do you have for us?
My other random choices... honestly, I feel like a guy who I would want to put on just about any given movie would be Brad Bird.
Because of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Yeah.
That, as well as, you know, just his work with Iron Giant.
Yeah. The Incredibles.
Incredibles, yeah.
He's doing Tomorrowland, right?
He's doing Tomorrowland.
But in particular, the Mission Impossible had that great mixture of kind of fun and action.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely on the side that does not want a super grim, dark Wonder Woman.
Me neither. I think it's what I get, but not what I want.
Slightly offbeat choice, but not too weird. Kenneth Branagh, who did Thor over at Marvel would make sense for the mythologically tied Wonder Woman.
Sure.
But they would never do that.
No.
My counterpoint to your, was it James
Lin?
James Lin is...
Justin Lin.
Or Justin Lin is James Wan, who directed the most recent Fast and the Furious, but is better known for probably his horror movies like Insidious or... The Conjuring.
Conjuring. Well, if you want to do
I mentioned him because of his... He seems diverse in what he can do.
Also, you know, just take the Azzarello portrayal of Wonder Woman, put him involved, and
right,
you get a really
B-horror.
You get a really horror fueled Wonder
that
Woman.
That would at least kind of fit. You know, I'll tell you what. I think if they were going to go grim dark with Wonder Woman, I would rather have Azzarello's kind of weirdly sometimes personal.
Yeah.
And, you know, the gods is really kind of alien and weird.
Yeah.
Versus just 300 with Wonder Woman.
I agree.
I would love to see Azzarello's story on the big screen.
Yeah, if they are going to do grim dark Wonder Woman, I prefer the Azzarello Chang version of grim dark.
I think those are my all of mine. Randy, you got anybody else to throw?
No, that's pretty much who I would pick. So there's some suggestions. This is not necessarily a dead project. I mean, they're going to make it happen, I think.
I think so, too.
But I would sure like them to get somebody good, because McLaren had me excited for the movie, and now I'm really bummed.
Right.
All right. So thank you, Joey, for the question, and we'll be back in just a few seconds to talk about this week's comics. All right, we are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, April 15th. And Dave, what do you got for us?
I haven't read a ton this week, but what I have, I've rather enjoyed. I, in fact, one usurped my initial pick.
Yep.
I'm going to cheater pick that initial thought later, in a minute. Actually, you know what? Let's start with that one first.
You can't start with a cheater
pick.
Okay.
Yeah, you start with your
fair
pick.
Fair enough. So my pick this week is Convergence Superboy.
Yeah.
This is interesting for a number of weird reasons. One is I did not really read Superboy in the 90s, which this is that 90s Superboy.
I have his first appearance.
I have his first appearance and the first 40 issues of his comic.
I only know him as the kind of cocky partial clone of Superman who appeared after Superman died.
I have an action figure.
No character is more 90s than him, with his round glasses, split level haircut,
his jacket,
jean jacket, and earring, and everything. Yeah.
Yep,
amazing.
I also like my initial flirtation with Convergence as a concept, like last week, when it kicked off in Force, was not strong. But when I I don't really like the main miniseries that shows the kind of Brainiac weird culling of all these worlds and stuff. I never really liked DC's big crossover events like those. But the individual issues, I've found several that I liked, and I found several that I liked last week. And this one, amongst a few that I've read this week that I've liked, kind of popped for its sort of its fun value.
Should we talk about the week's concept? Because that was one thing I didn't realize. Week one was the concept that everything was in Gotham City.
Yeah. Right.
Well, the main concept is there's a big dome that goes up for a year.
Right. Sort of locking in Gotham City and taking away the powers of the heroes. We still don't know quite why, but it sort of puts them in this almost survivalist mode where they have to survive on what resources the city had. And, like, for instance, in Gotham, Poison Ivy was apparently, you know, created this sort of botanical garden. Now, I don't know if she used powers or her...
I don't think she used powers, because...
Technology
works. That's the way I think. Super technology works, but superpowers don't.
She's also just really good with plants.
That's the thing. She could just be, like, growing food, but she was, like, helping sort of feed Gotham.
Yeah.
And lots of unusual sort of... It's almost as if the heroes might have been drawn there, because, like, Superman was
And a powerless Superman was trapped there.
Yep. But he was still kind of out there trying to do a Batman riff, because Batman is not there.
Well, and this thing... I didn't realize when I was reading it until this week when we get to week two, and it's in Metropolis. And it's the same thing. It's like Batman got trapped in Metropolis.
Yep.
And Superman was outside of it. And so it's a Metropolis without a Superman, and there's very little powers. And so all the concept this week is all – I wish they told us a little more how this tied together, because once I got that, I'm like, oh, that's kind of neat. All these are tying into like different aspects of Metropolis that was under the dome.
Yep. And they like – well, in like the Green Arrow one – There's he goes after kind of, aside from having some cool stuff with Connor Hawk, he kind of goes after this group that's like a white supremacist group.
Yeah.
And a lot of these stories have kind of focused on at least somewhat on what happened in that year of being locked down under the dome. And I was like, well, it's perfect for Green Arrow. I mean, that's the kind of social justice he pursues, because this is classic Ollie.
Right.
But it's also a survivalist type thing. It's like, what do people under pressure do? Well, sometimes the bad apples become worse. And,
yeah.
You know, so that's what a lot of these books have been doing. Although, in Superboy's case, his thing is, like, he is powerless.
Mm-hmm.
He's been at the...
Cadmus Labs.
Cadmus Labs, where, what is it, Double X and various others are trying to figure things out. And some
trying
of
to figure out why his powers aren't working.
Yeah, why his powers aren't working. And this actually explains... kind of more than some of the other books have, like, exactly why it isn't. Although we still, as readers, don't know the rationale, like, why... what is it? Telos, the Brainiac kind of like
offshoot
who's doing all this, like what he gets out of it. But it does. They do look into it, and there's some interesting thoughts on that. And
it's just a really good sort of character study of him.
I actually liked also seeing Double X, the who's like an alien telepath himself, speculating on who might be behind it. And as he notes, he's like, "There's a lot of supervillains who have this kind of technology." But he's like, but it's weird that they wouldn't come out to gloat about doing
yeah.
this.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was kind of a fun bit. And essentially what happens afterwards is they kind of forward a little bit after showing how Superboy's kind of, he's basically kind of in a depression over all of this. But then they kind of cut to the end where the dome lifts and he gets his powers back and he's excited. He's got the costume and all that. And then he's up against his foes, which, do we want to say who they are?
No, I think
you want to leave that.
I don't think
we
want to spoil
it. But they're known characters from sort of an alternate universe timeline kind of thing. So, and I think DC fans are going to be kind of enjoy who he's going up against.
Yeah.
It does seem like the part of the deal is Telos enforces who from, you know, has to face who.
Yeah.
Yep. He's doing March Madness brackets. I'm sure that whichever wins will fight the next group
like
of city.
I've noticed that in general, for whatever weird reason, it's like one person from the pre-52 universe, basically one person from the 90s, versus a multitude of people from some alternate universe.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think in weeks, like last week was like pre-52.
Yeah.
This week is pre-Zero Hour, if I'm
yeah.
not mistaken.
Yeah,
oh,
I think
yeah,
mostly,
you're right.
Yeah.
So this is the, yeah, specifically kind of 90s characters.
So all of that. And I think next week, I forget what it is, but each week of the 4 weeks is a different era.
Yeah.
But there's some good, just straight up action between them at the end, and a pretty good cliffhanger at the ending, that I will not reveal. Anyway, this was a surprisingly fun book that sort of caught me off guard, and took the top spot as a result of that.
It was written by Fabio Nicieza,
not a guy I usually like,
and art by what?
Carl Moline, who did
Frey.
Yeah, who's a very talented artist who I hadn't seen in a while, and I like seeing him on the book. My stealth pick that is probably the superior technical book.
Cheater pick,
yes, is the super late issue of Sabrina. This is thankfully it's more or less a standalone issue.
Yeah,
because otherwise I have no idea what was going on, or I'd forgotten.
Right,
but you know this was the one that's the period piece about Sabrina in the 60s, like when she was created.
Right,
it was using some elements of like sort of Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah,
and there was like very creepy witch stuff going on, and a more realistic kind of like EC Comics art style than say
right.
Francisco Francavilla in Afterlife with Archie.
Yeah.
This focuses on a character called Madam Satan, who
foreboding.
Yes. You know, actually, it's a kind of a cheesy sounding name.
Yeah.
But when you almost right from the first page, you're like, "This is
she's creepy and horrifying." Hell. Yeah.
She has what looks I can only describe as she emerges. We learn from hell.
Yeah.
What looks like a skinned face with like little baby skulls for eyes.
Yeah.
I don't know quite what it is. She's singing the song "Que Sera Sera."
Yep.
As she steals another woman's face.
Yep.
Anyway, it is as twisted as the first Sabrina issue was. She is seeking. She is the. What is she? The sort of spurned ex.
Spurned ex of Sabrina's father.
Of Sabrina's father, yeah. And she's kind of trying to figure out what's happened when she's been away. What happened to said father? And clearly is going to set her sights on Sabrina.
She's a scary bad guy.
She is super scary. The issue is actually very kind of casually. She very methodically goes about tracking this information down.
Right.
And doing a lot of very horrible things in this issue. So it's like, it's imagine a camera walking around watching a bad guy, like watching Hannibal Lecter or something do their thing. That's what this issue is.
Yep.
Anyway, also highly recommended.
So that transitions nicely into the other Archie book this week, which is an Archie Dark Horse collaboration, which is my pick for the week. It is Archie versus Predator, which is very anticipated. People love this concept. I've seen people talking about it. And this is not like Sabrina and Afterlife with Archie.
This is hyper serious.
This is more like Archie versus Punisher back in the day.
It is
an Archie book.
Like, out of curiosity, anybody actually read that?
Yeah.
It was fun.
Cool. Y'all both did? Okay.
It was written by Bat and Lash. It was a fun book. So if you If you're looking for sort of the more serious, dark, I don't think you're going to get what you want here. I think if you want to
see Jughead's brains blown out by a bolt from the Punisher, probably not going to happen.
I believe both Nick and Dave, you were not super overwhelmed by this one.
Yeah, I didn't, like, I don't have a huge fondness for the Archie comics. I felt like I might have been more into it. But it was still fun. Yeah.
But for me, this is basically the gang goes on spring break on this tropical island, and then the Predator lands.
Yep.
And you never see the Predator. This is like the original Predator movie where the Predator didn't show up to like halfway through.
Right.
You just have him in the background saying things.
I mean, there's a little Where's Waldo-ish because he's in the background.
He's hunting them, and they'll do the sort of the heat vision stuff and that kind of stuff. But this
is, you know what was funny? I don't think this is giving away too much. He's got, you see that sort of predator vision from the view screen, but there's like little emojis as that are sort of showing his assessments of his targets. That was just kind of a fun little addition.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun, but basically this is an Archie book. It's a book about Betty and Veronica and Archie and the gang down in spring break.
It's drawn in that original Archie style.
And they're, you know, while they're having their spring break, the Predator is starting to track them. And there's some funny nods here. My favorite, of course, is when Reggie shows up and says, "I'm a gosh darn sexual tyrannosaur," which is a riff on the Predator movie.
Of course, yeah, Jesse Ventura.
Yeah. And I thought this was really fun. And then we get to the ending.
I suppose, by the way, just in even having that line, it's slightly more risque than the average Archie.
Yeah.
But for the most part, this almost could be a regular Archie.
Yeah, except the Predator's lurking in the background, and toward the end, there's a pretty notable not Archie scene.
Right. Talking about the bloody nose?
No, not so much the bloody nose.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. There's also the bloody nose, though.
Yeah. But then, I'm guessing we're going to get more into the Predator stuff next issue.
Yeah.
But it was kind of fun. There's also a one-page backup story with Robert Hack, who did the art on Sabrina.
Yes.
Yep. Doing a Sabrina Meets Hellboy one-shot. Which was really fun.
I saw that, but I didn't read it. It's just a little one-pager.
Yeah, cool. But it was kind of fun. So that was a lot of fun. It is, like I say, if you're expecting Afterlife with Archie, recalibrate expectations. It is not that. It is an Archie riff more than anything else. But I had a lot of fun with it, and I think it's going to be a fun one to read. Nick, what was your pick for this week?
My pick was something I haven't really been paying attention to, but the cover of this one really grabbed me. This is the 9th issue of Sensation Comics featuring Wonder Woman.
Yep.
Cover, I think, is drawn by Mike Mahak.
Yep, who we had here last year for All Ages. Did.
And Sensation Comics is like their, not quite anthology, but
it's an anthology. Okay. And it's digital first.
Right, and it's sort of but it was a Wonder Woman series meant to kind of let creators do whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
If they wanted to do a lighter, sort of more cartoony story, cool. If you wanted to do Wonder Woman as Warrior, cool.
Right.
If, you know, any version that the writers and artists seem to want to do.
Yeah, and then this one actually has two different stories. The first one, which is drawn by Mike Mahak and written by...
Are they the same length, Nick? Or are they
they're about
one short and one long?
I'd say about 10 pages.
Yeah, they're both about the
written
same.
Written by Lauren
Bukes.
Bukes, yeah.
Which is actually a really, really fun one because it's about two sisters sort of having difficulties and like... playing with each other's toys and coming up with these great Wonder Woman stories in their heads. And it's just really, really fun. It's simple, beautifully drawn, I think has a great message. And is just...
And out of curiosity, is it more about the sort of the concept and the girls themselves?
Yeah, Wonder Woman isn't in it.
Yeah, she's not in it.
It's them playing Wonder Woman.
Yeah, it's them playing.
Okay,
and
cool.
It's just a fun sort of story. I think the voices are fantastic. The characters are great.
The cover, by the way, is by Ben Caldwell.
Oh, it's by Ben Caldwell. Okay.
Who also has that sort of animated style.
Yeah. But the art inside of this first story is definitely my thing.
It's great, yeah.
And it's beautiful. It, like, sees Superman being turned into a super pig. I mean, come on.
Yep. And turned into a statue.
Justice League?
No, Justice League, they turn Wonder Woman into a statue.
Yeah, Justice League Unlimited, they turn Wonder Woman.
Gotcha.
The second story I thought was my favorite. It's written by Cecil Castellucci, who wrote
The Plain James back in the day. She's a YA author.
Right, and art by Chris Sprouse, who did just
gorgeous
the multiversity stuff and a few other things. And this one actually sees Wonder Woman being interviewed by Lois Lane. And they're just sort of having their kind of interview. Lois asking really lowball questions, like what...
It's sort of pop cultural celebrity stuff. Like what kind of makeup do you wear and that kind of stuff.
That kind of stuff. And basically, an alien invasion breaks out. And just how Wonder Woman deals with that and sort of
how those two characters interact. And it sounds like kind of in counterpoint, I guess, somewhat to Lois's cheapy kind of pop culture-y questions.
And it's even she herself is not happy with questions she's asking. She's just reading from script.
Right.
And it's a lot of fun. I think it's a great example of what those two characters can be. And sort of, I miss them from the New 52 stuff.
I know that our former staffer, Dan Grendel, has been following this series and has also spoken highly of it. So it seems like, you know, although you're going to get different creators each issue, so you won't have like a certain even quality level.
Right.
It seems like there's been a number of stories that I've heard that have been hits for people. And so if you're looking for a variety of Wonder Woman stories.
And like Dave, I also have a cheater pick.
Yeah.
Because I like to copy people.
Sure.
No. My cheater pick is actually a trade paperback that came out this week, which is
outrageous.
Deadshot, subtitled Bulletproof.
Yep.
Which it's written by Christos Gage, probably back in the early...
It was the first thing he did in comics.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So this was like what? Earlier mid-90s? 2000s?
No, early 2000s.
Early 2000s. And art by Steve Cummings, which...
Yep. Who is currently doing Wayward for Image.
Oh, that's right. That's what he's doing. And this sort of sees, if I remember correctly, and Randy will probably, like a group of assassins coming after Deadshot.
Yeah.
Because they're going after his daughter,
introduced his daughter in this
one. Introduced
his daughter. That was a character that did not exist previously.
And this is just a great sort of collection of everything about Floyd Lawton.
There's also an issue where Deadshot takes on Green Arrow.
Yes.
This was a great series that put Christos Gage on my radar. Christos Gage, of course, is one of the writers of the Daredevil TV series.
And he's gone on to do a lot
of... He's done a lot of stuff at Marvel, Avengers Academy, all that kind of stuff. And this was great stuff.
You know,
we never thought they were going to collect it.
No.
What I remember is that at the time, we all liked it, but it kind of went under the radar of a lot of readers.
Yeah.
And so now, no doubt, because it's fostered by the Arrow TV show.
And Suicide Squad
and
upcoming,
Suicide
all that.
Squad stuff. Yeah, it's getting another shot.
Well, and they've seen, this is the collection. And they did another Deadshot collection not too long ago that was really,
the Ostrander
really good.
Stuff.
The Ostrander stuff.
And that one's a little darker. It's in tone with Suicide Squad. This is a little more action-y.
Yeah, this is definitely more action-y.
I love this series.
I remember I was shopping with us.
Oh, okay.
When this was coming out. And I think either you or somebody, or probably Dan, pointed it out to me, and I was picking it up, and I just loved it.
Yeah, I'm really happy they're collecting this. It is one of my favorite Deadshot stories. Worth a look.
You know, Nick, because you, I know you kind of, the Punisher was one of the characters that kind of was your entry point into comics. It sort of makes sense that Deadshot might be one of the guys that might draw you when you were getting back into it.
But Deadshot's a real villain.
He is, but he's got a code.
He does.
And this is more of a vigilante take on him.
And this also collects another one that, sees him going up against Batman.
Oh, that's right. That's that one shot. I forgot about that.
Legends of the Dark Knight one.
It's also Christos Gage, but art is by Phil Winslade?
It is. It's Phil Winslade.
Okay.
And it's, another
Winslade's
really good
art.
Story.
Yeah.
Even when he's drawing weird stories, which he sometimes
does. One was fun.
But it also, it's an interesting relationship that Deadshot and Batman have, and I always like to see it.
Yeah, Ostrander was the one who brought up that notion that they sort of have a weird sort of code of honor.
Well, the Deadshot pulls his shots around Batman subconsciously.
Right, like he couldn't kill
he
Batman.
He can't kill Batman, yeah.
Randy, do you want to throw in a cheater pick?
No, I'm not going to throw in cheater picks. I'm going to go to list of stuff I've got this week.
All right, let's do it.
So, the Convergence stuff this week, I was very down on Convergence last week, but having looked at this week's stuff, I both really like Superboy. I thought the Green Arrow number one was really good.
I like that too.
And also features Connor Hawke, which is kind of fun. I am not a fan of Frank Thierry's writing in general. In fact, I don't think he's written anything I've liked ever. And he's written a lot of things I hate. And I was really upset that he was doing Suicide Squad, which is one of my all-time favorite comics. He brought back Fat Waller, although not fully fat. She's still a little skinny, by the way. But has art by Tom Mandrake, who I really like. It's the classic squad, plus a couple new additions like Bane and Black Manta and Deathstroke. And I'm like, oh, this is what I want, but it's terrible. And I read it. And it's pretty good, as it turns out. He turned in a pretty good issue. So the Suicide Squad one I recommend. And then also the Catwoman one they did,
Okay. Which
has Catwoman as sort of the protector of Suicide Slum.
This is Catwoman sort of from Jim Balin's
era.
The sort of sexy Catwoman of the 90s.
And I wound up kind of liking that one. It's not my favorite one, but there was some neat stuff in there. And then also second issue of Mark Millar's Sean Murphy's, not Jason Murphy, different guy. Sean Murphy's Chrononauts, Which goes in a more Mark Miller direction than his guys become kind of scummy, but also still entertaining.
Yeah, it's very entertaining.
Miss Marvel number 14, which is a continuation of the Inhuman story they've been doing.
It's good.
Superior Iron Man number 7, which has some pretty notable stuff. And then stuff I haven't read yet that is on my list to read. Giant Days number 2, because I really like number 1 from Boom. The Fade Out number 5, which I believe starts a new story arc.
By the way, didn't the Fade Out just get a collection recently?
Yeah.
So if anybody's like a big Brubaker fan or a crime fan,
yep.
And you've been curious about the series, the graphic novel's out.
Yep. Speaking of graphic novels, they have the first color edition of the Krogan series, which is a series of sort of historical adventure novels or graphic novels that Chris Schweitzer, a frequent guest of the store, has done.
Yep.
Great cartooning, and in color, it looks gorgeous. They did a really nice idea. This first one is a pirate, so it's a pirate story, and I think people would dig it.
You know, I think there may be a quote on that from Stan Sakai, and I would sort of say anybody who likes Usagi Yojimbo should probably check out the Krogan series. Yep. That same mixture of, like, sort of a certain degree of historical authenticity, probably maybe even a little bit more intense in the Krogan stuff.
Yeah.
But with high adventure and great cartooning, that's what it shares with Usagi.
There's also the second volume of Bandette, which is by Paul Tobin and Colleen Coover, which is a sort of, she's a French art thief. It's kind of fun as a really fun cartoony look.
Who puts that on?
It is put out by Dark Horse. It actually is originally from Monkey Brain. It's a digital comic.
Okay.
Is it
an all-ages thing?
It is all-ages, yes. It is an Eisner Award winner for Best Digital Comic.
Oh.
It's gorgeous. Got beautiful colors. I'm really excited to see this. I've been really enjoying the series. And finally, the third volume of Stumptown, Greg Rucka's Portland Private Eye book, which I always enjoy. So that's all my stuff. What else have you guys got?
I have enjoyed Convergence this week quite a bit as well. And I had Convergence Aquaman that I enjoyed.
Yep.
Interesting.
Hey, who did the cover on that one?
That is Becky Cloonan.
Becky Cloonan. And that reminded me, the one thing I can't believe I didn't mention about Convergence Superboy is the amazing cover.
The Babstar cover.
By Babstar, which she was selling prints of when she was in town. But yep. It is just an awesome Superboy cover. It gets the attitude. Don't mess with the S. And I think she must have a fondness for the character.
I think, yeah, she must.
A little bit.
And then I have the third issue of the weekly Avengers Millennium, which sees a group of Avengers time traveling, fighting Hydra.
Mm-hmm.
It's been pretty good. And then the seventh issue of Thor, which was just downright fantastic.
I think y'all covered all the comics that I was going to mention, but I've got two trade paperbacks to mention. One is the new Biggie-sized compilation of Alan Moore's Top 10.
One of my favorite, probably my favorite Alan Moore book, actually.
Is this the entire...
It's the entire 12-issue series.
Yeah, yeah. And for those who haven't read it, it's about a... It's like a police procedural set in a city that is where every single citizen has superpowers. Whether you are the mayor or you are some homeless guy in the streets, yep, you have some kind of superpower.
And it's a multiversal city.
Right.
Yeah, there's like crossovers in different multiverses.
Right. It sort of nods to a lot of tropes in comics, but it is, in some ways, it still has a... Well, there's a lot of wit to it.
Yeah.
But it also follows certain tropes of police procedurals, and you see a lot of superhero ideas in there. And you know what's funny? A lot of these stories are actually really moving.
Yeah.
Like, there's cool stuff in it. Like, you know, our lead character is a young woman named Toy Box.
Yep.
Her father
built all those little gadgets. Yeah.
Right. And he was kind of, I think, maybe even one of those supervillain types, like the Toy Man and Superman and stuff like that. And so when she hits like a crime scene, she does like forensics and she'll like pop open her toy box and all these little toy soldiers and little cartoon helicopters and stuff go out and start collecting evidence.
Right.
But it has an amazing cast of characters and like I said, some surprisingly moving stories. I agree with Randy. There's a lot of one-shots in there. Some of them are some of my favorite Alan Moore stories.
Yeah.
So I think it's a must-pick-up for anybody.
And really beautiful art by Gene Ha and Xander Cannon.
Even if you're not big into superheroes, I think you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
But also on the superhero front, there are two collections out this week for the surprisingly good video game comic Injustice, Gods Among Us. Tom Taylor, the writer, really, I felt like he was writing DC characters better than they've been written in 10 years in some of these, even though it has the dark premise of the video game. And so what came out today is the soft cover of, was, is this
volume one of
year two, volume one. and the hardcover of Year 2, Volume 2.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Which I need to pick up.
Yeah.
So yeah, for sure, if you played the games, if you are like kind of DC Elseworlds type stuff, it's well worth it.
Yeah, because even if I read it before playing the game and had no problem picking up what the concept was.
Right, it doesn't rely on having played the game to know that to get in on the story.
Yeah,
there's also one more hardcover that I will mention.
Yep,
it is the deluxe edition of Batman Mad Love.
Oh, right. Which
is really, really cool.
Right. I think I checked just looking at it's shrink wrapped, but looking at the back, it does seem like there's some new stuff in there, like an introduction from Paul Dini, and I think like storyboards and some notes from like Bruce Timm. So it seems like I don't know if it's a lot of stuff, but you are going to get some extra stuff that you didn't get before.
Yeah. And Mad Love is, for those who don't know, the origin of Harley Quinn in the animated series.
Yep. It won an Eisner for best single issue, I think, of the year.
Yep.
There's a quote on the cover from Frank Miller proclaiming it the best Batman story of the decade.
Yeah.
And I agree with both of those.
Yep.
I think it's one of the great Batman stories of all time.
Definitely so. All right. We'll be back in just a few seconds to talk about our some TV and other stuff for this topics of this week. All right, so we are going to talk Daredevil this time, of course, but we're going to wait till the end so we can do a spoiler warning before it. So before we get to Daredevil, this weekend was Tabletop Day.
Yeah.
Which was,
went well.
Yeah, we had quite a turnout.
Sure,
a lot of games played. I even got to go back and sit down and play some Love Letter Batman, which I'll mention. It's just a really fun game.
I heard you got owned.
I got owned. I'm terrible at Batmaning. I got home by our staffer, Amanda, who's great at Batmaning. Love Letter, I don't know if you guys have... Nick has played Love Letter.
Yeah, Love Letter...
And I have not played main Love Letter, but Love Letter Batman is basically the inmates have escaped Arkham Asylum, Batman's trying to put him in. So Love Letter is 16 cards.
Yep.
And everyone on your turn, you will have either one card... Or if it's your turn, you'll have two cards.
It seems so weirdly simple.
And you have to play one. And the basics are things like each character has... There's like one Harley Quinn, one Two-Face, and they have very specific powers. Like Harley Quinn, if you have in your hand and you also have Poison Ivy or Two-Face, you have to discard Harley Quinn. So if someone gets their card in their turn and they discard Harley Quinn, that means either they have Poison Ivy or Two-Face, or they're bluffing.
So it sounds like and you told me about some of the other rules yesterday.
Yeah.
It sounds like once you kind of, especially when you know these characters, you're going to be able to infer a lot more.
It's a game of deduction.
Yes.
The main, you have five, there are five copies of Batman, and Batman's power is you get to guess what card someone has in their hand. If you guess correctly, they're out for the round. And the goal of each round is to be the last one standing. And if you're standing, you get a little Batman token, and the last person with seven Batman tokens wins.
Nice.
So that's how the rounds work. And if you guess correctly, you get a bonus Batman token for that, too. Mm-hmm. So that's what Amanda was like winning. She'd guess, knock somebody out, and get the round win and the guessing win. So she was the good detective who could figure out what people had, or maybe just lucky.
What you described reminded me a little bit of the smaller two-player game, Lord of the Rings, The Confrontation, which is sort of a Stratego-based game, where each one person's the bad guys, one person's the good guys, and each character has one or two, just like one key thing it can do and a certain way it can move that's almost chess-like.
Yeah.
And the key of it is in sort of deducing which ones you're looking at. It's like, oh, which, you know, if you're the bad guy, which one is Frodo? I need to kill him. And trying to figure those kind of things out.
Yeah, this is definitely
obviously not exactly like
this is a game of, and appropriate enough for Batman, deduction.
Right.
It's, you know, trying to figure out what people have. And Catwoman can let you look at somebody's hand.
Right, she steals a look.
It's all very neat mechanics. And the Joker is the most powerful card. Like, if you're holding it at the end of the round, you win. But at any other time in the round, if you're forced to discard it, you lose. I lost. Poison Ivy's power is to make you discard a card and draw a new card, which is usually no big deal. It just means you revealed something. Yeah. Joker, when you're forced to discard, you lose. Four times someone used Poison Ivy to make me discard the Joker.
But Randy's not bitter. Oh, no.
I am terrible at Batmaning and worse at Jokering. The only point I got was from one time when I had the Joker at the right time.
You had fun?
Oh, it's a really fun game. Yeah. And
there's
really
actually a lot of games that I've lost a lot, like Battlestar Galactica, for instance, that I still love.
it's a really quick-to-pick-up game, and it's really, you know, it's a bargain price. I think it's like $10.
Yep.
It's a really cheap little game. I definitely recommend the Love Letter games. The Love Letter Batman in particular, if you're a Batman fan, you'll enjoy. But we also, Dave, got to challenge everyone to geek out.
Yep.
After we had our tabletop, which included an X-Wing demo and Sheriff of Nottingham and Tear of Meeple City, a lot of Flux.
A lot of Steve Jackson games.
A lot of Steve Jackson games came out and demoed a bunch of stuff and gave away a bunch of stuff. After that, Dave and I...
sort of a post-day celebration challenge.
Yes, we said that we would take on all comers in the game Geek Out, which is a trivia game... That is a bidding trivia game.
Right. The two sides, or is it specifically two players, Randy, or did we just
no,
play it?
No, it's players. Like, usually it's individual players. We played as a team sport, which you can also do.
You bid for how many, like a sample question might be, name four Batman villains. That was one of them that would ended up being bid very high.
Because the bidding starts like, oh, we can name four, and then their team says, oh, we can name five. And it goes back and forth. Now, on the Batman one, we escalated a little faster than that, and we wound up naming 30 Batman villains.
Yes. Which did get a little bit tough near the end.
Tough near the end, and then we missed Catwoman and Mr. Freeze.
Yes.
I went obscure a little early.
But, like, on some of these ones, there was two... It started, I think, at, like, two mockumentaries.
Yeah.
And that one was pretty... That one...
We named four to win, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
But the interesting thing is the categories, you roll a little die to determine the categories... And they include comics, film, there's a miscellaneous category.
Sci-fi, fantasy.
And so you have different categories on each card. And it was a lot of fun. It's a fun little game. We carry it. And Dave and I, we lost the first round, right?
Yes.
We lost
we
the first round.
We were playing to five.
You were playing to five.
Sort of how you do.
Yeah, so. if you win the card, you get that card, and that's a point. Yeah. If you lose
it's
a question.
It's super easy to play.
If you try to bid higher than you can go and you fail to deliver, you get a little minus two chip, which eventually you lose two cards.
And you realize that's a real – losing 2 points sucks.
Yeah.
I think it only actually happened once during all of our – for either team during the whole time.
But
most of the times we were able to put our money where our mouth was.
Yeah.
We were playing a friendly game, so we gave everybody a little bit of time to think.
Yep.
So if you're like, God, what's another mockumentary? Let me think. And then you're able to come up with something 20 seconds later.
Yep.
We weren't, like, timing it.
Yeah. No, but it was a lot. It's a lot of fun. And we lost the first round, then we won the second, and then we won the third.
Yep. I'm just trying to think of some of the categories. There was, I believe, fictional horses.
Yes.
Let's see. Animated sci-fi feature films?
Animated sci-fi feature films. That was a tough one. We won that category, I think.
But we ended up with things like Akira, The Clone Wars,
and
cartoon movie.
Final Fantasy The Spirits Within.
Yeah, that's right.
We knocked a few, but it was tough. I believe the first one we won 4-5, or we lost 4-5.
Right.
The second one we won 5-4.
Yep.
And the last one we decided to play to 3, and we won 3-1, maybe?
Yeah.
But it was always pretty tight.
Yep.
So it was a lot of fun. We had a good time, and definitely recommend Geek Out.
I will say that, like, I think, I don't know if I just said this a few minutes ago, but most of the bidding did not get near 30.
No.
It was, like, somewhere between 5 and 10.
Although, if you remember, the last question we got was a comic book question. It was, name characters with the power of flight. And we decided we're going to do a different question because that one could have escalated to, like, 100.
Yes. Just about maybe like one in every three superheroes can seem.
Well, especially once you bring in the Legion of Superheroes, you know, all of whom have flight rings,
right?
Yeah, so
you can just start reeling off Legion characters.
Yeah. So, but it's a lot of fun, and we had a good time with that. Dave, I know you just started watching a show on Netflix.
Oh right, one of our former staffers, Mandy. She recommended this kind of randomly to me. I think she had just come across it because it's not a new show.
No.
It's the UK show called Broadchurch.
Yep.
Which is a small, like, small village. Like, maybe a...
Although, not as small as I would think. It's
I
a pretty...
I believe it's 5,000.
It's a pretty big-looking town.
Yeah, they say 5,000 somewhere in there. 5,000-ish.
It's a coastal town.
It's a coastal town. Essentially, it's an 8-episode sort of murder mystery.
Yeah.
But also sort of exposing sort of kind of a secret underbelly in a community that on its surface, you know, looks rather clean and idealist.
Yeah, that's not a no. We've seen that kind of thing before,
Everybody has secrets.
Like David Lynch, you know, did that with Blue Velvet. But this is very different from that. This is not the surrealist thing that is. This is, in a lot of ways, it's a procedural, but you also get inside a lot of the characters.
Yeah.
One of the best known of which is going to be David Tennant.
Yep.
As the head investigator of it.
Who, I've only seen the first episode, so I know he's got something in his past.
Yes. There's definitely, the episode very much plays upon the secrets.
And it's a murder. It's a murder in the town that leads to...
A murder of a kid.
Yeah.
And it's, So I was like, it was pretty disturbing, honestly.
It's pretty dark, anything, yeah.
It weighs on the whole episode. The scene, Randy, did you see the scene like at the, was that in the first episode at the morgue with the father?
Yes.
That was a difficult scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the uniformly great acting, I don't know the actress's name who plays opposite Ted.
It's Olivia something. And I thought of Emily Mortimer from The Newsroom. When I saw her. She had that sort of vibe to her.
I can see that. Yeah.
But she's really good.
I thought she was fantastic. Yep. Actually, I liked every character I saw in it.
Yeah.
I'm about halfway through it now, maybe a little bit more than halfway through, and kind of chomping at the bit to see how it plays out.
This has been on my list for a long time because I've heard it was really good. Mm-hmm. Fox did that remake of it called Grace Point with David Tennant. Did you see? You saw the remake?
Yeah, I watched the whole thing.
And I may watch the remake. I just out of curiosity, I don't know too much about what's going on. I just watched the first episode just because we were talking about it. And I've always been sort of shying away from this because of the whole child murdered thing. I'm like, this may be too dark for me. And it is dark, and you sort of got to keep your head from going there or it becomes not fun to watch. But it's so well done and so beautifully shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazingly shot. I don't know how I would describe the director's style, but they have an eye for sort of like – both those kind of like sun-washed sort of scenes during the day on like in a coastal area, as well as a lot of twilight type scenes, sun setting or early morning.
Yeah.
There's kind of these eerie beach scenes or eerie empty city streets.
Really, the cinematography reminds me somewhat of another foreign show I've liked, The Return, which I know I've recommended to you.
Yeah, I kind of like these short burst shows. So yeah. I'm going to fast track that
but,
one, too.
But yeah, I'm gonna try and catch up on the rest of Broadchurch this next couple
maybe
weeks.
Maybe we'll do a little follow-up in a few weeks when we've seen
we've seen the last 8. Oh, that sucked.
I don't think you're going to have that reaction.
Yeah. No.
I will say there have been like a handful of things where I'm like, I don't know about that, or that seems slightly melodramatic, but like I'm like talking like just one or two small scenes that are very, very few criticisms of the show so far.
All right, so now we're coming to our spoiler warning.
Okay.
We are going to talk Daredevil. We have seen, in mine and Nick's case, 13 episodes, in Dave's 6.
Yeah.
And
five episodes.
I've already spoiled Dave on one of the big things from the second half by accident. So if you have not watched all the way through Daredevil, just because I don't accidentally spoil anyone else, wait till you've watched all of Daredevil, or if you don't care about the spoilers before you listen to this segment, we're going to close out after that with a bit of a tribute to Herb Trimp. But other than that, you'll be missing anything this week.
We can probably say to the people who might be skipping this for spoilers that we all really liked it.
Yes.
That much you can at least know.
We all really liked it. Definitely go watch it as soon as you can. Okay. On to the spoiler portion of the show.
Yep.
So this was great.
Yeah, it was very, very, very good.
Game changer for superhero TV.
The buzz had been strong early on, and I expected it to be pretty good, but I don't think I thought it was going to be as good and have as sort of singular a vision as it was going to have.
Yeah. Now, I know you and I, Dave, especially, darker superhero stuff's not always our bag.
It's true.
And I know I was worried about it. You were worried about it being sort of a hard R, which it isn't. It's more of a dark PG-13.
Yep.
The violence is pretty R-rated.
Like some of those FX shows, I notice people say shit a lot.
Yeah.
Because that's sort of the upper end of their
But they don't drop
level.
The F-bomb.
No F-bomb.
Which is funny because that's not Netflix. That's the show deciding because there's plenty of nudity and F-bombs dropped in Orange is the New Black and in House of Cards.
Right.
They're determining, but I would say this is closer to a deep PG-13.
But I will say, before you start letting kids, the violence is really,
don't,
really horrific.
Don't let your kid watch this unless you also let them watch Walking Dead, and don't let your kids watch Walking Dead.
the violence, you said really violence, horrific. I don't think it's like, there are fight scenes that are just kind of bloody fist fights.
But I'm talking about, there's
how about
fight
what happens
scenes?
To Healy?
Right, no, there's that is that. Really bad, but even that is effectively off camera.
There's some dark stuff.
There's fight scenes with bones popping out of them. They go into a little bit some darker territory after the ones you left.
What I was going to say is they don't linger on the like really graphic stuff sometimes.
Well, they did decapitate a man with a car door.
That's true.
But all you saw was the door swinging shut. You did see
and the body,
body
fell out.
And the wet smooshing sounds.
Yeah. No, I definitely compared this to Walking Dead.
Okay. Well, y'all have seen more than I have. I would say it's not as nearly as gory as Walking Dead from what I had seen.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I will say this. It's the goriest Marvel-related thing we've ever seen.
Yeah. This is not. It's, what's War, what's not interesting is that despite it being so dark, it does fit in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
It does.
Right. It makes it. It's. It they feels like a darker corner.
Even in the episodes I saw, so they acknowledged it, and there was a joke at some point about somebody said, you know, it's like you don't have a magic hammer, you don't have metal armor.
Yeah, right.
And so they sort of acknowledge it, sort of tongue in cheek that way, but it does play into one kind of key nifty plot idea. Yeah. Which is that the... Can we say this?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
The Hell's Kitchen, of course, of Stan Lee's 60s, which was like this kind of dangerous urban area,
yeah.
has, in our gentrified times, become like...
Become a hipster area.
Become a hipster yuppie kind of place. But they made out in the show that after the destruction, I think from...
Battle for New York. The Avengers.
The Avengers movie. That it basically got trashed, it's been rebuilt, and it's a bad place again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there's all this opportunity of corruption because people are rebuilding this area.
Right,
yeah,
right.
That was a great conceit. Yeah,
Enter the Kingpin and other a lot of the central antagonists that I saw at least are sort of about there was about five key mob families.
Yep.
With the Kingpin rather shadowy for the first several episodes. And making a very notable appearance. Yeah.
Well, there were the Russians, the Triad, the Hand, although they're never called that, but they're clearly the Hand.
They're the Hand.
And then Leyland Owsley is sort of his guy, I guess. But
he also runs money and stuff like that. Yeah, and after Owsley, there is a fifth member, which I don't know if we want to go too far into.
We gave a spoiler warning.
Okay, I mean, she's definitely a part of, like, Kun Lun.
Oh, the Triad. Well, she's from the Triads. She's Chinese Triads, but they reveal later on. Yeah,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
There's a Kun Lun reference clearly.
There's even a reference of who she actually is, which is interesting.
Yep.
And I think that's it, right?
Those are the crime.
And ones. I think they give a lot of moments to each of those crime families.
They do.
And I think that was actually necessary to make you actually care about some of them, because like the Russians are just the Russian mob,
right?
But they get an interesting backstory, which is one of the more horrific ones.
Yeah, yeah. David, I don't know if you saw that one, Dave. That
the
was
Russian one in the prison.
The prison. You did see that? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that was like a little bit squeamish.
It has a crime show vibe,
yeah.
Although it's also a vigilante show.
Yeah.
But it also definitely has that sort of Marvel bent in the sense that there is still humor involved.
Yeah.
The banter between Foggy. And Matt is. Fantastic. I think they perfectly cast the show.
Foggy was important, and they really nailed it. Yeah, the casting, everybody is here is good.
Yeah,
am I correct? They essentially recapped the origin pre-credit sequence.
Right? Yeah, pre-credits, they showed him being blinded. That was it.
Yep.
And then they did flashbacks to him and his dad.
And then they have a very cool opening with sort of depicts this, like, almost like liquid blood falling over New York and creating the shapes as it lands.
It could be viewed as two different things. It could be viewed as the blood sort of covering the city, or it could be how
his radar
views the city.
Yeah. And both work really nicely with the show's themes.
I also thought...
The logo, which I thought was
fantastic. Yeah, the logo's great.
Like Daredevil logo.
I thought, Foggy was perfect, and casting Foggy was important, and he's really good. Karen Page was really good.
Yeah, and... Honestly, he's only the guy who plays Foggy has only been in a few things I've seen. The biggest being he was in the Mighty Ducks series.
Yeah.
Everybody I know who mentions it, who knows him, who's seen that, mentions it. I haven't seen it.
And the woman who plays Karen, which I'm blanking on her name at the moment.
She was in True Blood.
It was in True
Deborah
Blood.
Deborah M. Wool.
And I've seen some episodes of True Blood with her in it. It's not a great show. It's not for me.
Yeah.
But it's nice to see her. Her acting ability is fantastic.
I don't think anybody expected those two characters to be as strong as they
were.
No.
And Charlie Cox as Matt Murdock in Daredevil is really, really good.
He was great casting as a sort of leading man.
And I've only seen Charlie Cox, a lead in Stardust.
And he was in Boardwalk Empire.
Boardwalk Empire. You know, this is a weird thing, sort of prejudicial thing to say about Foggy.
Yeah.
But I'd seen some pictures of him online, and I was like, this dude looks kind of weird. He's kind of quirky looking.
Yeah.
He had like this weird, weirdly long hair.
Yeah, they gave him a weird hairstyle.
He's got kind of. I grew to like it almost instantly. But he just kind of has a quirky face.
Yep.
And I'm like, it's not like Foggy's supposed to be all leading man chiseled, but I was like, it doesn't look like Foggy in my head.
Yep.
And then I just instantly liked his interpretation.
Yeah.
Like, I thought it was fantastic. Almost. A scene stealer.
Yeah. Vincent D'Onofrio plays a much more sensitive Kingpin than we're used to seeing. In fact, they never call him Kingpin.
It's weird to say sensitive, but
But he is. I mean, his personal life is.
He's sort of nuanced. Yeah, and yet it does incorporate a classic element of the Kingpin in the comics.
Yeah, Vanessa.
He has always been this heavy-duty guy, but periodically, his devotion to his wife, Vanessa, has been such that he has almost given up his crime empire because she disapproves.
But here we see him courting Vanessa, which we've never seen in the comics.
And the show also just gives us a bigger picture of who Wilson Fisk is.
Yeah, they give him a backstory.
Which I actually think is necessary because
it was a good idea for TV.
Because Dave hasn't seen the backstory episode.
Right, but in a lot of sense that you want to like these characters. Yeah. And even though you know the Kingpin is evil,
you need to be intrigued by it.
Yeah, and I think, Vincent D'Onofrio turns in a fantastic performance just in every scene.
I heard somewhere, it was one of our customers or what, saying that D'Onofrio himself had a lot of input on the role.
That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, like kind of had a notion of how his portrayal would be.
Well, even the cadence of his speech is a little bit different than what you
I expected a booming voice threat.
Yeah.
And instead, he actually, in some of his early scenes, he seems awkward, and you almost feel sorry for him, and he's like, he doesn't know how to interact with people really
and
well.
And they play that throughout,
Right, but he's a guy who is like, has a lot of intelligence working behind it, who can clearly become exceedingly dangerous physically at a given time. So he's got that sort of mafia movie threat that you get from, in some ways, from guys like Joe Pesci or Robert De Niro. But he doesn't have, like, their bravado, and that was an interesting new take on him, I think.
Yeah. They also, they have a guy, and this character is from the show, the comics, I hear, John Wesley.
I did read that as well.
And he's, like, his right-hand man, and he was great.
Yeah.
John Wesley, he's a guy from the comic. He was
Basically the guy that we've seen before. The show? The guy who's always sharp-dressed suit. He actually is from the comics.
Okay.
Yeah, Kingpin's sort of front man.
Yep.
And I thought that was a good way to bring him in, because we didn't even see D'Onofrio until the end of the second episode.
Correct.
Well, you know, one thing we talked about a little bit while we were watching it was that in the rather failed Ben Affleck movie, one of the difficulties that they faced that really wasn't their problem, but just the problem of sort of movies, is that you try and cram everything sometimes into a movie. So in the very first Daredevil movie, they tried to have Daredevil's origin, Foggy, Elektra, Kingpin, Bullseye. This is like, it was like his most famous story in a story that also introduced him and all that stuff.
Yeah.
This TV show shows how much better he works when he kind of has time to, his story has time to breathe. And all their stories have time to breathe.
Well, one of the key things is in this one, you don't have to have the Kingpin be the guy who killed Matt's father.
Right.
No. That was one of the problems, is that that's a common thing. It's with Joker and Batman, too. In the movies, it's like, oh, we can't introduce another antagonist just for that. In this thing, like, oh, no, his dad was killed by the Fixer, and Kingpin had nothing to do with it. And because otherwise, you're bringing in an element that changes that relationship.
Right.
And I think it was really a key that didn't happen.
They also brought in, by the way, Ben Urich.
Yeah. Curtis Von D. Hall. Curtis Von D. Hall is the guy. I believe he's a Wire alum. He's also been a bunch of stuff.
He seemed pretty naturally great.
He was great as Ben Urich. I thought they did a great job with Ben Urich. And having him and Karen Page is one of those things where you could easily have been bored by their story while you're like, get back to Daredevil. Why am I watching these two do reporting stuff? But instead, they did a really good job, and you were interested in their investigation and how that was going.
Yeah, Karen is a character who, too often in the comics, you know, this really goes for a lot of girlfriend characters from the 60s. That's all they were.
Yeah.
They were just, they were the love interest, but you know that the 13-year-old kid reading this really just wanted to see Daredevil kicking butt.
Yep.
And so you kind of gave her no deep personality.
And they've given, and the show gives her a lot of backstory, a lot of nuance that was missing, I think.
Yeah. She's a much stronger character, I think.
We also see Scott Glenn, a stick,
which Dave has not seen that episode.
But I know he's in
the episode of Stick is great.
It is.
We were trying to explain Stick to our friend Jarek, who was there. And he's never read that bit of Daredevil, so we're like, well, he's basically an asshole Yoda.
Yeah, he's an asshole Yoda,
and that is pretty much exactly how Glenn plays him, and it's perfect, and he's great. And they're leaving a lot of that for second season, clearly.
Yeah, Scott Glenn just chews up every scene he's in, like he does in pretty much everything.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, like, Hunt for Red October, he's just a badass.
Yeah.
And,
but, you know, he's not a scenery chewer in the way that, like, say, Jack Nicholson.
No.
It's like a quieter, but, you know, he kind of has a
simmering charisma.
Yeah, yeah.
That sounds very sexual.
Yes.
Simmering.
No, but that's right. He's got a presence to him. And
even when the first time I saw him was in Silverado back in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
And that dude looked old then.
Yeah. I think, scenery chewing sort of, I think, implies sort of Al Pacino type yelling and Nicolas Cage type. And this is definitely not that kind of performance, but it is he's a big presence.
He does command, I'm guessing, he commands the screen when he's on.
Yeah. There is also, we haven't talked at all about the action.
Yep.
Which is fantastic.
Right.
It really is.
And sort of staked out its own territory. Just in the five episodes I saw, any number of times our conversation kind of turned to Korean action movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially, I heard people mention The Raid.
Episode 2 has that that big, long sequence that reminds you of Old Boy.
Right.
As well as True Detective.
Right. It's a done-in-one-shot.
It's a big one-take, yeah.
Which we heard, I think, I don't know if this is confirmed, but was legitimately one-take, no
legit one-take. There is a Christos Gage, one of the writers, posted online that an article explaining how they did it.
Yeah. I was thinking as I watched it, I was like, okay, when the camera moved at this one juncture, or, you know, like, even if somebody, got knocked past the camera, yeah. I was like... They probably changed. That was probably a cut right there, and I wouldn't have blamed them for it.
No, but there are places. Kind of, I think they had it in places where they could have digitally edited if it just didn't work.
Yeah,
but they didn't need to.
Yeah, and so I was very happy with it. I was like, knowing that they didn't just makes it that much more impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a Daredevil who gets exhausted in his fights, who fights guys who sometimes just like a dude who's like a knife wielding hitman.
Yeah.
You know, clearly supposed to be a very tough hitman, yeah. But just sort of a normal guy.
Yeah.
Gives him like a real tough run for his money. Yeah, he does that. He gets very hurt in the series.
He takes a beating throughout. Yep. You haven't even seen all of it, David. He takes a beating.
I believe it though, because I mean, you know, that is part of his comic life, or often has been. You know, he gets torn up a bit. Yep. And they definitely chose to make it a thing on the show.
Yeah,
which also we didn't mention Rosario Dawson.
Rosario Dawson playing Claire Temple, aka Bill Foster, aka Black Goliath's ex-wife.
Right.
Yep.
That is not mentioned in here, but that's who she is in the comics, and a former paramour of Luke Cage, which means she'll probably tie into the Luke Cage show.
Do we think that she probably was influenced by the somewhat obscure character Night Nurse?
I think she was supposed to be the Night Nurse character. Yes,
a character that sort of bent an old Marvel '60s character from like sort of their romance comics,
line. Yeah, yeah.
That Bendis kind of revamped in the early 2000s as this woman who would sort of take care, you know, on the sly, take care of superhero injuries.
Right.
And that's sort of what she does, but it's not in the formalized way it is in the comics. She's a nurse.
Yeah, she's a nurse.
But she kind of knows what Daredevil is doing and sort of agrees with his crusade.
Right.
Tentatively.
Yeah. It's a great show. There's a couple things coming up in the tail end that I don't want to spoil for Dave, but... But there's
promise some good things.
There's some good stuff. Episode 7, episode 10 are particular favorites of mine. Just great stuff. I will almost certainly rewatch this again. I'm happy that I watched it in 13 episode burst, which I never do. But I really love watching it all in one shot.
It would seem to bode well for Netflix's Marvel series. Yeah.
Well, it also, I mean, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. should be embarrassed at this point. And for that matter,
Nick is shaking his head.
It's still, you've got to admit, this is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is nowhere near this.
It's a different animal.
But honestly,
and they make nods in Daredevil to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So
honestly, this is also kind of what Arrow wants to be doing, and it's better than Arrow.
Yeah,
because it's on.
And I think that's just network.
It's cable versus network.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah. Netflix in a weird way, though, has a lot
of what I saw of Daredevil isn't necessarily what I would have wanted from Arrow. Because I like that Arrow can like kind of still work it. I feel like it, even though it's darker, in concert with The Flash, which is a notably lighter show. And I'm not sure Daredevil. I can imagine Daredevil's world, say, interacting with The Flash.
I can imagine Daredevil interacting with Avengers.
I could see that. The Marvel Cinematic Universe has a little bit more weight going on.
And I can
on.
See Daredevil interacting with S.H.I.E.L.D., so.
Yeah. I can too, actually. But I think that. The thing is, it's getting people I've seen who are not big superhero fans, but are TV fans.
Yeah.
And they're saying, wow, I did not expect this to be so good.
You know, this is kind of what Marvel's been good at.
Yeah.
You know, with all of their movies, is people who don't think that they like superheroes are like, oh, I get it. You know, Thor or Iron Man or whatever. It's like, there can be wit and great action scenes and characters I actually really like.
It's not just cheesy.
It's not just a bunch of dudes punching each other.
Yeah.
But this has certainly made me more excited for... I mean, I was excited about AKA Jessica Jones anyways.
Yeah, me too.
But now I'm like, can we have it tomorrow?
Yeah, I want this now. I think it's going to be this year. We have no idea. I think it's going to be this year, but I don't know.
It's going to be probably late this year or early next year.
Oh, man. I don't want to wait another year for that. It was great.
Well, it's filming right now. They're showing shots right now.
Okay.
So
probably later this year.
I would hope so.
Maybe in the fall.
But, you know, 13 episodes of that.
Yeah.
Then I think next year we'll probably get the Luke Cage and
I bet they're going to fast track Daredevil season 2 after this. I bet we see this sooner rather than later.
I would hope so.
I mean, can you imagine? We can come to a point where Flash, Arrow, S.H.I.E.L.D., Daredevil, and whatever Luke Cage are all on the show, all on TV at the same time.
I don't think they can.
Why not?
Because these are all sort of leading up to the Defenders story.
Sure, but they know what they're doing with the Defenders.
I know, but I think some of the story elements are going to carry through.
Like, in other words, we'll in Daredevil season 2, he's going to have to be talking about his work with the Defenders.
Post-Defenders?
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be post-Defenders.
Maybe so. Oh, man, I don't want to wait two or three more years to see more Daredevil.
It's the first world problems, embarrassment of riches that we're in.
Oh, my God, I have to wait.
Yeah, it is a crazy notion that there could be,
over 60 episodes.
Like, 6 or 7, really good superhero shows going on at a given time. And like, what? How? Yeah. When did this happen?
Yep. All right. A sad note for us to close out the podcast.
Sort of a fitting one because of the tie to G.I. Joe, which always closes out our show.
So we've heard that Herb Trimp, the artist who was originally G.I. Joe, co-created Wolverine, and worked on Godzilla and any number of other Marvel books, has died at the age of 75.
Yep. I actually did not see what he passed away from.
I don't know either, but
that's sort of just breaking to me.
That's a good run. I mean, 75 is a good run.
If it was a comic, it'd be a good run. It'd be a good issue run.
This is the guy who, I mean, obviously from our sign-off, Herb Trimp, without Herb Trimp and Larry Hama, I don't know that we're all here.
Right.
The three of us all got into comics from G.I. Joe.
Yeah, it's true.
And, you know, what's interesting, though, he drew that first issue, and I think maybe, you know, a few issues afterwards, but he was not the regular artist.
No.
But he drew the all-important first issue.
Yep.
He drew all the Special Missions issues.
Yep.
Which, you know, what's interesting about Herb Trimp, he's got a little bit of, say, like, Steranko in him.
Mm-hmm.
And also a little bit of, I think, some of the sort of more illustrator-type EC Comics guys. But he does not have a style that's real polished. Like, I used to kind of think, this is kind of an ugly style when I was a kid.
He's not John Romita. He's not, even Steve Ditko or any of those guys. He was one of the workman guys.
The inker on the first G.I. Joe, I think, was, Bob McLeod?
Yeah.
I think. He kind of softened his stuff a little bit and realismed it up a bit.
Right.
But what he had was, like, really strong basics. And I feel like he might have learned from some of those classic comic strip guys, like the guy did Milt Kniff, who did Terry and the Pirates and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When I would be reading issues of G.I. Joe's Special Missions, when I sort of later learned to appreciate layout and sort of basics.
Not just Flash, but
more than Flash, yeah. I felt like I was seeing echoes of that in there, and that is a strong compliment. You know, those guys were great storytellers, great action adventure comic artists. I know some of the earliest comics my brother had that I read were his Godzilla comics, and he did a lot of that, which probably got him the spot on G.I. Joe.
He also notably did, because
S.H.I.E.L.D. was had a heavy presence in there, and S.H.I.E.L.D. is basically the proto G.I. Joe.
He also notably did a lot of Hulk, which is what led to Wolverine,
right?
Yeah, he's by no means one of these legendary, like, people aren't going to know his name the way they know, like, say, Romita or one of these, but he was one of the big Marvel guys.
Yeah, he was,
and
I
without
think,
him, there'd be no Wolverine.
But
that'd
be
right,
Wolverine.
So, yeah, it's like, we might not be here, and the industry might not be here.
So, and we're going to close out, as always, in tribute to Herb Trimp.
That's right.
Yo, Joe! And that'll wrap it up for us this week. As always, you can drop us email with topic suggestions, things you want us to hear about, or just comments on the podcast at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at roguesgallery. Check us out on Facebook. Check out our website at www.roguesgallerytx.com. Check us out on Instagram at roguesgallerytx. And if you want to help us out, go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and a little review. We'd very much appreciate it. And we will be back next week.